This is Going Up Alleys, a podcast. Episode 1, The Cosmos and the Collider, Our Quest to Understand the Universe. To the Going Up Alleys podcast. This is your host, Stephen Sekula, and I'd like to thank you for listening to this inaugural episode of the podcast. I've been sort of toying with the idea of creating something to go along with my professional blog for a while, but I haven't really had any material worth sharing or anything interesting to say. Now that I have a little bit of spare time, I've started thinking about what kinds of things I'd like to share on this podcast to augment the posts I make about physics and other topics in my professional blog. I recently had the pleasure of being invited to give a public lecture as part of Southern Methodist University's Godby Lecture Series. This lecture was in a upper room in a restaurant near campus, and people that were there had paid for the chance to come and have lunch with a speaker and listen to me, in this case, talk about particle physics. And so I got to thinking about what I was going to say, and I decided that I would try to encapsulate the excitement that certainly I and many others in the field feel about the current state of physics and the threshold on which we're poised to make great discoveries. So please sit back, relax, or do whatever it is you're doing when you listen to a podcast and enjoy this little public lecture on the cosmos and the collider, our quest to understand the universe.
The fabulous history it's had and continues to go forward. And we actually are lucky today that Professor Stephen Sekula is able to join us. He was appointed the Assistant Professor of Experimental Physics at SMU in 2009, so he's been with us for several years now. He led the team, actually, that discovered in 2009 a state of matter that had eluded detection for 31 years. And its name is a so-called ground state called bottomonium, and so that's a key word for folks who study this, and so please know that he brings wonderful credentials. He's currently a member of the ATLAS Collaboration, which is at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, and he's searching for evidence of new forces and particles. Here we go. I would say that the major takeaway is just to know that he really enjoys communicating about science to a broad audience, so I think it's a perfect match for today. So.
Stephen,
please.
Thank you.
Sure.
It's a real pleasure to be able to speak with you today about the breadth of my field. As a physicist, as with any practicing scientist, you spend most of your time deeply immersed in your subject, and necessarily so, because you're wrestling with the details of nature, and it's the details that matter. It's the process that matters. And so on a day like today, when I get to spend time with you all, talking about the breadth and wonder of the field, the thing that got me interested in this subject in the first place, that for me is a deep and profound pleasure. So I want to thank all of you, first of all, for coming to listen to me speak today about the connections between the cosmos, the great expanse of our universe, and the collider, which is one of the fundamental tools that we in the physics community are using to understand the cosmos. Now, my talk today will be done as if in the form of a symphony. And there will be four movements. Okay, the first movement will be entitled Things Great and Small, and I will discuss the cosmos and how we understand the picture of the cosmos now, from the greatest structures in the universe to the smallest structures in the universe. And then I'll move on to a question of what lies between all that we see. And that will motivate the third part of this lecture, which is entitled An Eye That Sees What Eyes Cannot. How is it that we can perceive the cosmos at its most fundamental level in an attempt to understand the cosmos at its greatest scale? And then finally, I'll conclude with the farthest shores of time and space, when I'll talk a little bit about the challenges that face us and the discoveries that we're hoping to make in the coming weeks and months. You can think about the quest of science as a quest to understand the cosmos at all possible distances, from the greatest things that we can see in the night sky to things we can't even see with our own eyes that are in the night sky, down to the smallest workings of atomic structure and the things that live within the atoms that make all of us up. And I would liken this quest, this act of discovery, as one of exploration. where you have ideas about what might lie across the great distances of thought and space and time. And you go looking for those things, and you may find surprises. Okay, our own continent was discovered largely by accident while somebody was looking for a better way to get to Asia to establish trade routes. And as scientists, we take that quest of discovery very seriously. We think we know what's out there. We have great experience with the oceans of knowledge that we already have within our grasp. The question is, are we prepared for the things that we don't expect? And can we make sense of them when we discover them? And so what you see here is a map of the discoveries of England and Spain and Portugal, the great powers of the time, and the parts of North America and South America to which they laid claim. And what I want to direct your attention to here is that this quest to find land, this quest to find resources, is very akin to the scientific quest to understand the inner workings of the entire cosmos. And so if I show you another picture now, hopefully you'll recognize this structure. That may be a little dim on here, but this is the Big Dipper, the constellation also known as Ursa Major, the Great Bear. And it is actually this constellation, which, thanks to a science writer named Timothy Ferris, is one of the three things that got me originally interested in physics. I can tell you about the other ones later. One of them was actually the death of my grandfather, which was the first death in my family that I ever had to deal with. But that was actually a doorway into something that was unexpected. So looking back on it, without that event, I never would have been catapulted into experimental physics. And also the third thing, which is the influence of my father and mother on me as I was developing and growing up, and the opportunities that they gave me to explore the cosmos through music and literature and science. And the Big Dipper, the story of the Big Dipper that really caught me, this really hooked me as a teenager, is the following. The speed of light, that is the speed with which light, for instance, travels from that chandelier to my eyes, is, as far as we know, the fastest that any information can travel from one point to another in the entire universe. However, that speed is not infinite, meaning that it doesn't take zero time for light to get from that chandelier to my eyes. Light travels extraordinarily fast. Very early attempts to measure its speed failed because it traveled so much faster than anyone was prepared to expect. 186,000 miles every second. And yet, when you then put that on the scale of the cosmos, it seems pathetically slow. All right, so let me ask a question, and you don't have to raise your hands if you don't want to. Is anyone in here between the ages of 70 and 80 years old? Yes? Okay. Then you stand in a moment of great importance for the Big Dipper, because you have the pleasure and the privilege of actually seeing the Big Dipper as it appeared on the day you were born. It takes light from these stars 70 to 80 years to make the journey from those stars to our eyes. And these are not even very far away in cosmic scales. The other side of our galaxy, which is visible in the night sky if you have a really good camera and can take very long exposures. On very clear nights, you can even see the great swath of stars that forms the Milky Way, the center of the Milky Way. We sit on one edge of this great expanse of stars. It's 100,000 light years across. That means it takes 100,000 years at the speed of light to cross our galaxy. And that's our cosmic neighborhood. To get to the next nearest galaxy is 2.5 million years. So when we see Andromeda, the Andromeda galaxy, in the night sky, if we look at it with a telescope, we're not seeing it as it exists now. We're seeing it as it existed 2.5 million years ago, when the light left the stars of the Andromeda galaxy on their way to our planet here, in our little corner of the Milky Way galaxy. The universe is a vast place. It is an old place. And we're only now beginning to really understand what happened near the beginning of time that set in motion the laws of nature and the structure of the cosmos that emerges in what we see today. So this is a picture of our very local neighborhood. Okay, this is Devil's Tower, which is a beautiful structure. I had the pleasure of seeing it up close once. And here you see our galactic neighborhood, and here's Earth. And these are the scales that we're used to dealing with. Earth is a very familiar place. Things are right-sized for us. We're very comfortable here. Where we start to get uncomfortable where we start to lose familiarity with nature is when we begin to ask what is inside of us, what is deep inside of all of us. Cells, bacteria, viruses, not so crazy. We can picture them. We think of them as wee little animals running around and causing havoc in our bodies, right? We think of the functioning of our cells as miniature factories. And that analogy works really well. But then when you start digging deeper, digging into the fabric of the very atoms that make up cells and viruses and bacteria, we start to enter a very unfamiliar world. What you see here is a grid of carbon atoms in graphite. Graphite is one of the most common substances that we have access to. It's the foundation of pencil lead, okay? So you're seeing the atomic structure of pencil lead revealed here. Each of those little circles is actually a six-sided hexagon, and at the tip of each hexagon is a single carbon atom. Now, this picture isn't blurry because we don't have good cameras. This picture is blurry because our concept of where things are and how fast they're moving completely breaks down. We like to think that you are there, I know where you are. You are there, I know where you are. I can see you. I know how fast you're moving. You're sitting, you're not moving at all. You're nodding your head, you're moving a little, right? That's good. But all of that concept of where something is and how fast it's moving completely breaks down when you get to the atomic scale. At the atomic scale, if you don't think of everything as waves, as undefined objects, where they're mostly located here, but they're also sort of located over here, and then also a little bit over here. If you can't grapple with that concept, you can't make sense of the atom. It's impossible to make sense of the atom, the building block of all that we consider matter, without first accepting that you cannot both know where an atom is and how fast it's moving. So what you're seeing here is not bad camera work. You're seeing, in fact, the most precise camera work we have for imaging an atom in a way that a human can understand. What you're seeing, in fact, is the fuzziness of nature at its most fundamental scale. To go even deeper, to go inside the atom, there are no pictures. There is nothing I can show you that you can look at and go, ah, that is an atom with its cloud of electrons on the outside. That is the nucleus of the atom, like a tiny sun at the center of this electron solar system. So we have to resort to computer graphics to give you the idea of what's going on. The atom is not like our solar system. It is not a central object with things orbiting it very clearly, you know, a place where the electron is and where it is not. Electrons are smeared all in orbit around the atom. You cannot say with any definite certainty where the electron is at any moment. You can only say where it might be and with what degree of probability it's there. And deep inside the atom lurks an even more fundamental structure, the nucleus of the atom, which is made from protons, which carry the opposite electric charge from the electrons. It is the protons that define an atom itself. If you change the number of protons, you change the atom. If you change the number of electrons, you change the chemical property of the atom, the way it binds to other atoms. And then deep within the nucleus as well, there are these little things called neutrons. And for some mysterious reason, which was not understood for a very long time, these protons don't mind hanging out with each other very tightly packed in the center of an atom, whereas their positive electric charge should be blowing them apart, yet they remain stuck together. And I'll comment a little bit more on that at the end. But we've been focusing too much on what we see and not enough on what lies between the things we see. Take, for instance, this example of the map again. It's very common to focus on the land masses. After all, it's where we live. It's where we explore. It's where we walk. It's where we run. It's where we drive. It's even where we fly from one place to another. We end and start our lives on these land masses. But what lies between the land masses makes up most of the surface of the Earth. The great oceans between the continents, they really, overall, dictate the behavior of things like climate and weather on this planet. It is the vast oceans and their ability to store tremendous amounts of energy to be released in hurricanes and other kinds of forces that really dictates the quality of our life here. What happens in the Pacific Ocean affects the weather over Dallas. It may not be a direct cause, but it is a cause. And so it's that 75% of the surface of the Earth that we should really be worried about, and which we as humans, we've really only started to explore in the last century by going deep into the ocean and exploring what's down there, looking for the kind of life that's down there and seeing whether it makes sense with what we know about land animals and land creatures. And likewise, we've been overly focused on what the stars are made of. We know now that the stars, like us and the Earth, are made of atoms. And that many of those atoms were formed at the beginning of time, but the atoms that we're made of were actually forged in the hearts of stars that exploded and died, and scattered their remnants across the cosmos to be later collected in the form of plants and then creatures like us. It's an astounding tale. But what we've learned very recently is that it's what lies between the stars that matters more than what's in the stars themselves. We stand now at a time of great opportunity, a chance for great discovery, one akin to the time that existed 100 years ago when a great university, Southern Methodist University, was founded. The president and founder of Southern Methodist University, Robert Heyer, was a physicist. Okay? So I can identify a little bit with him. He was a product of his generation in the sense that he was very taken in by a lecture that he saw by a man named Heinrich Hertz. Heinrich Hertz was the first person to transmit and receive electromagnetic waves, the very thing upon which all of our modern communication is now founded. Robert Heyer saw this lecture by Heinrich Hertz, and he was inspired to go back to his laboratory in Georgetown, Texas, and transmit electromagnetic waves to the jail downtown, just about a mile away. But it was the first time anybody did that in the United States. Electromagnetic waves were newly discovered because it was only very recently, within the 20 years prior to that, that our understanding of electricity and magnetism had really fully come into being. And our understanding of space and time, thanks to a man named Albert Einstein, came into being. And it was in 1905 that four really critical papers, were published by Albert Einstein while he was working as a patent clerk in a Swiss patent office, because he angered so many of his professors in college. Although he was very bright, he could not get a job in academia. So his friends helped him get a job in the patent office, and he had a lot of time to mull over the things that he'd started thinking about as a student. And as a result of that, he came to some fundamental revelations about space and time that, for the next 100 years, changed our understanding of the cosmos and set in motion great technological revolutions. We stand at a time now of similar revolution, where we thought we understood that everything we see is all that there is. But what lies between matters more. What we know now is that the great expanses of space between stars and galaxies and vast galactic structures actually matters more. There's a form of matter. We have not yet identified its constituents, but it is called dark matter, and that is meant to indicate our lack of knowledge about it. Dark matter, as far as we know, makes up about 24% of the cosmos. The atoms, the stuff that you and I are made of, the stuff the Earth is made of, the stuff the sun is made of, all the planets, all the stars we've ever seen, that atomic matter is 4% of the universe. So we've spent as human beings a tremendous amount of time getting very familiar with what turned out to be a small player in the overall cosmos. There's an even larger player, a larger player named dark energy, about which we know even less than we know about dark matter. We do know this. Whatever dark energy is, it is slowly pushing the cosmos apart faster and faster and faster. Stars and galaxies very far away on the edge of the ability of light to reach us are slowly going to vanish out of sight. Now, you won't notice it in the night sky. The objects you see in the night sky are fairly close. It'll be very, 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 very long time before those get pushed away from us. But every year, some objects very far away are disappearing out of our ability to see them because the cosmos is expanding faster and faster and faster. That's all we know about dark energy. And that discovery was worthy of the Nobel Prize last fall in physics. We were very lucky to have Dr. Saul Perlmutter, one of the recipients of that Nobel Prize for the discovery of dark energy by looking at distant stars as they explode and how fast they're moving away from us. He came and gave a commencement address at SMU and has an honorary degree from SMU. It was a real pleasure to meet him. What you're seeing here is dark matter. The blue areas that you see shaded here are highlighted so that we as humans can understand what we're seeing. There are masses of stars. Actually, these are masses of galaxies here. So each of those blobs is a mass of galaxies, each one 100,000 light years across. And these are probably thousands of them. Okay. The blobs that you see there are where most of the mass, most of the weight is. And most of the weight is very far away from what actually makes up most galaxies, which is hot gas, which is the stuff that's in red here. What happened was a very long time ago, these globs of galactic clusters smashed into one another. The stars basically pass right by each other. The distances between stars are so vast in these things that they didn't even notice each other. But the gas collided between these two great blobs. And the gas is very hot, and it gets all tangled up in itself, and it's stuck here in the middle of the collision. You can even see what looks like a sonic boom shockwave over here. In fact, that's what that is. It's a leftover, essentially, of a sonic boom in the gas clouds. These blue lobes, however, are where most of the mass is located. And most of the mass is not associated with those bright lights that you see there. It's associated with the space in between. And this was one of the first images that conclusively showed that dark matter really is a form of matter that barely talks to itself, but is gathered around galaxies and clusters of galaxies. So what is it? And can we make it on Earth? Can we see it on Earth? Can we detect what it's made of in the same sense that we detected atoms and what atoms are made of and what makes up the things inside of atoms? That's the question that's before us. Now, we can also ask the question, has the dark matter and the dark energy always been with us? What you're seeing here is light. This is a sky map of light. Now, this light is very special. It is the oldest light in the cosmos. It is left over from a moment about 300,000 years after the Big Bang. After the universe came into being, it was hot, it was dense, and light could not travel very far. It kept getting trapped by one particle and then another particle. But then eventually the universe cooled and hydrogen formed. And when hydrogen formed, the universe became transparent to light. And light was free to travel as far as it could before it ran into something. And that light has been free streaming through the universe since 380,000 years after the Big Bang. And this is it. It was originally detected by accident. People weren't really looking for it. It was a prediction of the Big Bang theory. It's been confirmed. And you can actually see it if you have an old cathode ray, I say old, but this is what I grew up with, an old cathode ray tube based TV set in your house. If you have a cathode ray tube based TV set with an aerial antenna, you can tune into the light left over from the Big Bang. All you have to do is tune to a station that doesn't come in, so all you get is snow. Tune the brightness down until you can barely see flecks of light left on the screen. One in every 100 of those little flecks of light is a photon, a particle of light left over from the moment of the creation of the universe, striking the antenna on your TV and showing up as a blip on your TV screen. That was another thing that I learned from the science writer Timothy Ferris, which got me very interested in physics. Okay. Now, by studying this light, you can think of the universe as a symphony. A symphony that is composed on space and time. It has instruments and players, each that play their part and conduct this great masterwork. The fundamental subatomic particles and the forces that bind them together into what we call reality. This is the result of these players playing their part. And the question you can ask is, well, were dark matter and dark energy playing a part in the symphony at the beginning of time? Does the light left over from that moment before light became free to travel bear any imprints that suggest that dark matter and dark energy were playing a role back then? And the answer is yes. If you study how these little fluctuations in temperature in this map of the light behave, you can't explain them with only atoms. You have to put in something that behaves like dark matter and something that behaves like dark energy. All of this convergence of information happened in the last decade. So these discoveries, 20 years ago, if somebody had said, the universe is, I postulate the universe is mostly made of stuff we can't see, you'd have been laughed at. But in 1998, and in the years after that, a great number of discoveries happened that couldn't be explained otherwise. And the only way to consistently explain all of them, and this thing was the real clincher, looking at this light, was to say, well, okay, we have lots of evidence that there's something around galaxies that behaves like matter, but we can't see it, dark matter. Dark energy came as a real surprise in studying all of this stuff, as to how necessary it was to understand our cosmos. And so far as we know, it's been there since 380,000 years after the universe came into being. But here's the question. Was it there before light was free to stream? And how would we see it? If light was only free to stream to our eyes 380,000 years after the universe came into being, how are we ever going to build a telescope powerful enough to pierce the veil behind which light was not free to stream? And if light is not free to stream, we can't see it. So how are we going to pierce the veil? And the answer is with the most powerful microscope ever constructed by humans, the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland. Every particle collider is simply a machine that accelerates fundamental subatomic particles up to vast speeds and therefore high energies and smashes them together. And all the evidence we have from the cosmos says that at the beginning of time, the universe was a very high energy, very dense place. And so by smashing particles together at high energy, you're recreating a moment in time at that energy after the universe came into being. You are, in a sense, as the saying goes, creating little bangs. You are simulating in a laboratory a moment in time in the universe, a millionth of a second after the Big Bang, a billionth of a second after the Big Bang, and you can ask the question as a scientist, what laws govern the behavior of the universe at that moment, at that energy? And that is how we probe time with space and energy. We go to high energy, small particles, and that allows us to look at a moment in time that our eyes will never otherwise have access to, because light was simply not free to stream to us at that time. The Large Hadron Collider is the latest and greatest in a long line of particle colliders. It operates at an energy so high that it's essentially recreating the universe less than a billionth of a second after it came into being. And the question is, do we really understand the universe using what we already know about the universe from earlier experiments? Do we know enough to explain what we see there? And if not, how do we understand it? And how does that inform our understanding of nature as it was then and as it is now? If we go inside of this long tunnel, okay, this is a, if I go back here a second, this tunnel is immense. It's about 17 miles around. And it's typically something like 100 meters under the ground. Okay? It's filled with all kinds of equipment, which is the heart of the machine. And these are magnets. And magnets are like the lenses of the particle accelerator world. In the same way that a lens focuses light, a magnet can be designed to focus a beam of electrically charged particles. And really, that analogy works extremely well. And in fact, we call this beam optics, the study of the transport of particles from one point to another by using electric and magnetic fields to steer them and focus them. These devices here are superconducting magnets. There's a superconducting magnet at the heart of every magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, machine. So how many people have had an MRI scan before? Yeah, or know somebody who has. That's probably everybody in the room. When you're laying inside of the magnet, you're laying inside of a device that can carry a huge amount of current, that is moving electricity, but at very little cost in energy, because the wire itself is offering zero resistance to the flow of electricity. That's superconducting. And the heart of these machines are superconducting magnets, which were originally developed for particle physics, my field, and have spun off into all kinds of other uses as a result. The question is now, you can get particles up to immense speeds and therefore up to immense energies, but what are you going to see? How are you going to see what is not visible to the naked eye? Our eyes cannot see atoms. We have to use instrumentation and interpretation to come to pictures like those carbon atoms. But deep inside the atom, at the subatomic level, it's even harder. And so how is it that we are going to see what is happening in the collision of the particles in the beam that then results in some kind of phenomenon? And can we understand that phenomenon? And so what we need is something that gives us the ability to see what cannot be seen with our eyes, to extend our senses beyond the comfortable five senses we use every day in life. Now, how do you detect something you cannot see? The simple answer is, you look for its effects on everything around it. I have here a picture of a fairly calm body of water, and you see that it's been disturbed by something, and your eyes immediately pick up on the pattern. Something is moving through the water, likely going to the right, and is disturbing the surface of the water. And I could even draw a line down the center of that and say, that's the trajectory that the object, presumably a boat, was following. So in order to detect that which cannot be seen, you put something in its way and look for the effects of that thing on the target you put in its path. And that's exactly what we do. And the way that we do this is with a tremendous machine called the Atlas detector. It is the largest particle detector ever constructed. It is 8 stories tall, and it is half a football field in length. So the next time that you're in Ford Stadium and you're enjoying an SMU football game, Imagine a structure half the length of the football field, 50 yards, and 8 stories tall. That's the size of the Atlas experiment. And that's just the experiment. That's not even the cavern and all the stuff that goes around it. I know it's probably hard for people at the back to see, but there's a person here at the bottom center of the picture. There's a person for scale. So you can take about 10 of those people and stack them up and reach the top of the picture. Okay? And this is not a giant. This is a perfectly normal individual that we have working on Atlas. All right. This is a vast structure. And what you're seeing here is not the full detector. This is actually only a very small part of it. This outer structure are more magnets. We need magnets in order to bend electrically charged particles so that we can figure out what kind they are, where they're going, and how much momentum, how much energy they have. More stuff gets inserted inside of this cavity here. And so what I'm going to show you in a minute is actually in 1 minute, the construction of the Atlas detector sped up over 4 years. Okay? This is a bit more fully formed version of Atlas. Now you can see it's got more central instrumentation inserted inside of it. And all of this instrumentation you can think of as a giant digital camera. Each layer of the camera has a purpose. Its purpose may be to detect one kind of particle or another kind of particle. And when we get the full picture of each collision of these beams of particles in the Large Hadron Collider, we can image each collision that we take. We can get a sense of, by working back through all the trajectories that all the particles take, what was going on in the center of the collision. What was the universe like at that moment, at that energy? That's the quest. There's beauty in all of this, too. I mean, I find that these structures can look very gargantuan, very ugly sometimes, but there's some real beauty in these machines, intentional or otherwise. What you're seeing here is a device whose job is to measure energy, and to do so very precisely. It's called a calorimeter, and the SMU physics department was very involved in the design and development of this calorimeter technology for Atlas. Along with lots of colleagues and collaborators across the globe. And you can see here this beautiful honeycomb of electrodes inside each of this accordion layer of this device, each layer meant to sample energy from a particle to see how much energy it has at that moment, the next moment, the moment after that. There's real beauty in all of this. So here in a minute is the construction of the Atlas detector. It starts in 2004 and it ends in 2008. And you can just watch this and get a sense. I mean, this is really sped up, okay? You can also see there are cameras in the hall, so you can actually log on to the web and take a look at some of this stuff as it's running now. But you see they're putting in now the magnets. They bring in the central ones, they lay them at angles, and they keep angling them around the cavern. And then they insert the various parts of the calorimeter for measuring energy. Here they're putting in some of the devices that sit on the end to help us capture particles that try to go out the ends of the detector. You can see them moving the calorimeter into place. Okay, more devices are bolted onto the wall of the cavern to help us catch particles that punch all the way through the Atlas detector. And yes, there are things that punch all the way through 8 stories of detector. It's just the way it works, so you got to catch them as much as you can. Here's some more magnets being installed in the end. And then finally, these last wheels are bolted onto the end, okay? So this is a tremendous effort, and this is not an effort devoid of human interaction. I mean, science experiments are not things that, actually, let me go back there for a second. Science experiments are not things that are devoid of people. Before I get onto that, though, let me show you this animation. This represents a bunch of protons, which are the fundamental thing we accelerate in the Large Hadron Collider. They're accelerated to low energy, then higher energy, then even higher energy by putting them into an even larger ring. And then eventually they're injected into the Large Hadron Collider itself, where they go through final acceleration up to their final energy. And then the beams will go inside the tunnel here. You recognize the Large Hadron Collider magnets here in blue. And we're zooming along the cavern now. We cross from France into Switzerland on our way to Atlas, which is at point one. Now we're looking inside one of these protons that's going to smash into another proton. The proton itself is made of other particles that I'll talk about later. And now finally the proton comes in on its final trajectory, and it's only one of hundreds of billions of protons in each bunch. So it's not like you fire one proton at another proton. The chance of hitting if you do that is zero. So we have to take hundreds of billions of protons and fire them at one another and hope two of them hit. And then finally, you're left with this beautiful spray of other particles that come flying out of the collision and slam into all the little bits and pieces of the Atlas detector. And you know, if you imagine, these are electrically charged particles, particles without electric charge, different masses, different energies, traveling four stories, six stories, eight-story distances inside of this vast detector, some of them punching all the way through into the cavern wall, and they just keep going. Okay, this is a tremendous amount of energy that's being released here. And it's done 40 million times a second. So 40 million times a second, a bunch of protons meet another bunch of protons. So it takes a tremendous amount of computer work to do this. It's distributed both at the CERN laboratory, where the Large Hadron Collider is located, and across the entire globe. There's even a pocket of computing that we use for physics research here at SMU called the High Performance Computing System. It's a real gem for the university, and its usage is being expanded, but it was built with Atlas in mind. And so it scales with Atlas in mind. And Atlas is a big problem. Here you can see a cartoon representation of how it is exactly we tell different kinds of particles apart. You know, it's like using the wakes of boats to tell different manufacturing types of boats apart from one another, different engine types on different boats. There are only about four or five or six particles that we really can see that live long enough to make it all the way out into the Atlas detector itself. Some of them don't get very far, and so they tend to dump all of their energy very early on, and we capture them, all of their energy. We can measure their momentum, and from that we can figure out what they are. Some of them punch all the way out to the outermost, densest parts of the Atlas experiment. They leave giant sprays of energy when they finally stop. And some of them, like this thing called the muon, punches all the way through and just keeps going. Okay? Just keeps going. And then there's even more elusive particles, which are called neutrinos. They don't even see the Atlas detector. The Atlas detector, for all intents and purposes, doesn't even exist to them. So they fly on through. They fly on through the Earth. They keep going through the atmosphere, and they're off. You know, we'll never see those neutrinos again. We have all kinds of techniques we use to infer that a neutrino was there. So it's a very tricky game. And it's a game that's not played by computers. It's a game that's played by people. People that care deeply about science, they care deeply about the scientific method, they care deeply about the quality of their work and the implications of their work. So what you see here are pictures in the upper right corner here, these three pictures, are other faculty members that I work with at SMU. Richard Stronofsky is the PI, the principal investigator of our Atlas group. Jingbo Yi and Bob Kehoe are two of my colleagues. We're all faculty on the Atlas experiment. And we all have the pleasure of working with great postdoctoral fellows. So these are people that have their PhDs but haven't made it into a final professional position yet. They're working for that. Graduate students, even undergraduates. So we've had a few undergraduates get involved in Atlas. And that's getting easier over time, so we get to include more of them as time goes on. Atlas is a very daunting experiment. Any experiment at this scale is daunting at first, but it's getting less daunting as we understand it more and more and more as time goes on. And of course, it's not just SMU. I'm not, you know, trying to say SMU is running the show here. There are 3,000 people on the Atlas experiment alone, 3,000 physicists, okay? That's an incredible number of people. In physics, this is the first time this many people have been brought together on an experiment, and there aren't just one of us. There are two experiments that have 3,000 people. It's like a corporation, and there's certainly all kinds of grades of management going all the way up to the top. This is just a fraction of the people on the Atlas experiment photographed in one of the buildings at CERN. Okay, so there aren't 3,000 people in this photo. Not everybody can be present at CERN all at once. We rely on the internet. We rely on telecommunications and giving presentations remotely to collaborate with one another. We can't be at the same place at the same time all the time. So what is it we're doing? What is it we've discovered? As I said earlier, you can think of the universe as a great symphony that's still playing today. And we're still learning exactly who the players are in the symphony and how they play their parts and why they play their parts. Now, in the old way of thinking in physics, the universe plays out its great composition on a staff paper known as Space and Time. Space and time, or simply space-time, is the framework on which all things occur, all events occur. And for a long time, we thought that space-time was fixed, that it was unchanging, that it literally was like staff paper. You lay it down, and then you put the notes on it, and the staff never changes. But what we learned 100 years ago is that, in fact, the staff paper of the universe is flexible, it's bendy, it's stretchy. Space and time can be altered by energy and matter. And energy and matter are told how to move by the bending of space and time. It's a beautiful dance. And so really, if we were to imagine this grid of space and time around Earth, Earth has mass, and it warps the space and time around it. And this is what we know as gravity. This is how we feel gravity. This is why we're attracted to the Earth, why we don't fly off. There are forces that play their part. They bind the composition together in beautiful ways. Electricity and magnetism, or simply electromagnetism, is one of the most familiar. Gravity is the most familiar. We're held to the ground. When we drop things, they fall to the ground. When we fall to the ground, we fall to the ground. We're very familiar with gravity, although it is the weakest of all the forces we know about. It matters to us, but it doesn't matter so much to subatomic particles. Electromagnetism, it was what holds the atom together. It keeps the electrons in orbit around the nucleus of every atom. It's what binds atoms together. It is chemistry. It defines chemistry. It has very familiar macroscopic forms like thunderstorms over Dallas, which we're all very well acquainted with. Lights, however, are another form of electromagnetism. Light itself is an electromagnetic wave that travels from where it starts to your eye. It causes the optic nerve to respond with an electric current that sends an impulse to your brain, which your brain interprets as sight. That's also electromagnetism at work. Electromagnetism is everywhere. The reason that I can lean on this lectern and my hand doesn't pass through is because the electrons in the atoms in my hand repel the electrons in the atoms in the lectern surface, and I don't pass through. If not for that, there's so much empty space between atoms in my hand and that lectern, without electricity to keep me from falling through this, I would simply pass through the lectern. I'd pass through the floor. Okay, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. Less familiar forces, but no less important, the weak nuclear force, which we only discovered when we started looking very closely at the nucleus of every atom. But it is responsible for the nuclear processes that allow for the sun to ignite and give us the energy that we rely on every day to survive. And then finally, there's the strong nuclear force, which is responsible for keeping those protons that would rather be repelling each other because of electromagnetism. It holds them together. It keeps them bound together tightly in the nucleus of the atom. And these are the forces that we're probing with the Large Hadron Collider to see whether they continue to hold up as we know them when you go back to a time less than a billionth of a second after the Big Bang, after the universe came into being. This is the picture we have of the universe that we know about. There are 12 building blocks, 12 fundamental, indivisible subatomic particles. Now, we say indivisible because we haven't seen evidence that they can be divided, but they might be divisible. We just don't know. Six of them we call quarks. Two of those, up and down, U and D, they make up all the protons and neutrons. If you want to just make protons and neutrons, you just need up and down. These other quarks then seem kind of spurious, but in fact, because they were present at the beginning of time, we can make them today and study them very closely, but because they were present at the beginning of time, we're actually here to have this conversation at all. At the beginning of time, equal amounts of matter and its opposite, antimatter, were created. And they should have met each other in mutual annihilation, leaving nothing but light in the cosmos. But they didn't. Matter won out. Everything we see in the night sky, everything here on Earth, is mostly matter. 99.999999% matter. Why? Why is matter favored over antimatter? Part of the answer to that is because there were six of these quarks at the beginning of time. Having six of them allows for a tiny little effect, a little mathematical symmetry in nature that would otherwise spell our doom, is violated. And because it's violated, we exist. And that's kind of stunning. We still don't really understand that phenomenon fully, but that's also part of what we're trying to study with the Large Hadron Collider. These others are more familiar. The electron, which is in orbit around the heart of every atom, it has cousins, the muon and the tau, that have the same electric charge, but they're much, much heavier, and we don't know why. We also don't understand why the quarks all have different masses. That's a mystery too. But why would you need six quarks and six leptons all with different mass? That's weird. Why would you build a universe that way? Right? These are the carriers, the transmitters of the forces I mentioned earlier. The photon carries electromagnetism. The Z and the W carry the weak force. The gluon carries the strong force. And gravity, we don't know if gravity is carried by something yet. We just know that it's a warping of space and time, and that's about all we know. Behind all of this, we think there's something called the Higgs particle, or the Higgs boson, or the Higgs field. And it's needed in order to explain where mass came from at all. It doesn't explain why things have the mass they do, but it actually explains why anything has mass. And this is the thing that we're really focused on discovering at the Large Hadron Collider, because it has eluded detection since it was proposed in the 1960s. We have not seen direct evidence. We've seen plenty of indirect signs that it's there, like hints and whispers of its existence from the subatomic world. But no one has sighted the land on which Mount Higgs exists. Okay? We think we know what Mount Higgs should look like. If it rose up over the horizon, we think we'd be able to recognize it. But we just haven't, to this date, built an accelerator and a collider and a detector powerful enough to actually penetrate far enough into the depths of subatomic ocean to see Mount Higgs rise above the horizon. That may be changing. Don't be scared. Okay? This is the only plot I have in my entire talk. And I'm only showing it to you because in the analogy I've been giving you, that scientists are on a great quest crossing an ocean that is vast and whose breadth has never been completely and fully established. That quest may be drawing to a close, but opening an entirely new chapter, in the same way that discovering the New World opened a new chapter for the European states. These colored bands, think of those as your expectation that the horizon will only ever be water. That as you go further and further in this great and vast ocean, all you will ever see is water. Water upon endless water upon endless water. These colored bands are what you expect if there is nothing to be discovered on the other side of this ocean. When this black line pokes up above the colored bands, you may have discovered the first hints of mountain peaks rising over the horizon, signaling a great and vast expanse of land never before discovered, but whose discovery has been predicted for a long time. We have hints now that this Higgs particle is poking its head up above the expectation that there is nothing on the other side of this horizon, that it is an endless expanse of water that will go on forever. Mount Higgs is beginning to rise above the horizon. And if it's really there, if we haven't just hit a statistical fluke and been unlucky and think we've seen something and suffered some collective hallucination of land, after many years at sea, it's possible that in the next 6 months, with even more data about to pour out of the Large Hadron Collider, and even higher energies than it poured out last year, that Mount Higgs will be clearly discernible above the horizon. Right now, we're seeing what we think is land through a hazy, fuzzy edge on the horizon. But this summer, and certainly by the end of this year, we'll have sailed far enough into the Large Hadron Collider to know that Mount Higgs either exists or doesn't exist. But here are the questions we don't know the answer to. How many Higgs are there? We know about dark matter. Dark matter doesn't fit anywhere in this picture I showed you with all the building blocks of nature laid out on it. We don't know what dark matter is. Is it one particle? Is it 20 particles? Maybe dark matter is just as rich as all the atoms we know about now. Who knows? What remains to be discovered on the continent marked by Mount Higgs is an unknown question. And it is discovering that continent and exploring its reaches that we are just perhaps about to do. And so I'll close with this. The cosmos is a vast place. I feel humbled before it. And yet I am in awe that it has so far been understandable and intelligible. And it will take all kinds of efforts, not just with colliders, but with astronomical observations, with all kinds of observations to make sense of the universe we live in, and to understand what it might have been like near the beginning of time. And maybe one day, even at the beginning of time, we'll understand what the universe was like. But right now, we stand at an era where the collider, acting as both microscope and telescope, and in a sense, time machine, is getting us to a point in our understanding of the cosmos on this vast journey back to the beginning of time, to its farthest shores, that maybe, maybe we're about to spot a new continent and a whole new wealth of questions that we didn't even anticipate. Thank you very much.
This has been Going Up Alleys, a podcast by Stephen Sakula. Music was provided by Nikoko. The song is Occipital from the album Classic Coco, available for download on Jamendo.